Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Charles Ellison, political strategist, host of the Ellison Report here on WEAA every Sunday night at 9 p.m. He is here with us. We like to call this Ellison Tuesdays. Marta Mossberg is with us. She is visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute, and Dr. Lawrence Brown, public health consultant and assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
We're talking about the Supreme Court, but also the politics of this in this election coming up. 410-319-8888 is the number to join in. We'll come right to the phones here in a moment. But let me posit something. I was talking to our Steve Klepper about this. He had the same thought I did this morning, which was interesting. I see this election unfolding. I watched what Trump said this morning, where he was talking about maybe possibly.
I didn't hear it.
He was going to sue Cruz.
Yeah. Why?
He's going to sue Cruz because of the attacks he's making on him.
Defamation.
But then he said maybe. And then he also threw up, maybe I'll have to run as independent. What he was saying again. Right? So if you look at this election, I started thinking this election could be like the election of 1860. When Abraham Lincoln won, I think, about 37% of the vote. Mm-hmm. Because you could have, for argument's sake, I'm not predicting this, but you could have a Republican nominee, whoever that might be it Cruz or Rubio, whoever that might be, Kasich. You could have Trump running as independent. You could have Sanders winning the nomination for the Democrats. And you could have, that means that Bloomberg is going to jump in as an independent. So it could be that kind of setup. And it's an interesting point because I don't think America has been as ideologically torn in an election like this. Maybe Roosevelt elections to a degree, FDR I'm talking about. But ideologically torn is this since that time in 1860.
Well, you know, we've had a two-party system. I mean, the two-party system has provided stability for so long, but this election is just showing how the elites of both parties are so distant from the people within their parties. And I think it's possible that that could happen, and it's just so strange that we're at this point. But it's been a this trajectory for generations now, a generation now that's led us here. So,
yeah, you know, it's. You do have a lot of resentment, a lot of anger because of this dismissal of what I've seen over the past several years. I think we've had this conversation before, this persistent, like, 30% of the population. And so, you know, you see, you know, and also the growth of independence of people who are becoming non-affiliated with the political parties. Now, independents are dominating in terms of the pure just basic numbers of folks who are voting in elections. And so, you know, that's why you have the parties grasping so hard onto primaries because they see this rise in independence as existential threats. But, you know, there's been, especially on the Republican side, and that's why you see the rise of Trump, and also the rise of folks, insurgents like Cruz and others and Ben Carson, this persistent 30% like the Tea Party. We should have been over the past several years really trying to have a conversation with those folks, but especially folks like us, pundits, folks in media. We've been ridiculing them, you know, particularly since the 2010 congressional midterms. As like, oh, you know, and those are the folks who consistently believe that Obama was born in Kenya, that, believe that the rebel flag is a sign of Southern heritage. But, you know, that's a big chunk of the population, and we need to kind of get to the bottom of exactly, well, where are they coming from? What are they seeing that we're not seeing? And why are they having such a loud voice throughout the American political spectrum, as ridiculous as their arguments might seem or sound?
Lawrence. You know, I think Donald Trump is like the avatar of white fragility. and what I mean by that is there's research is showing that white folks between the ages of 45 and 64 are dying at a higher rate than before. The mortality rate is increasing. And so I think there's an anxiety, and actually a lot of those deaths are due to suicides and substance abuse, particularly opioid overdoses. And so I think we see here in Maryland as heroin is becoming a public health crisis. In Maine, it's a big public health crisis. New Hampshire is a big public health crisis. So even in these very white states, I think there is a crisis of being white in America. Maybe it's deindustrialization. Maybe it's the implementation of NAFTA in the 90s. Maybe it's the loss of those types of manufacturing jobs associated with that. But I think we're at a crisis point where white people are trying to figure out how they're going to make it in America, which seems a very ironic thing to say, given that the society is highly racist. But I think whiteness as a political construct sort of sold the promise that white people would not have to go through the type of anxieties that they're going through right now. And so I think that Donald Trump is really a representation of that, and he's playing a very slick game. That's why he can attack Cruz and Rubio. Well, not really Rubio yet, but he's going after Cruz and even Jeb with his proximity to Latino-ness and otherness. And he's really trying to hone in and capture, I think, that white fragility vote. And I think that's the dynamic. And even Bernie Sanders, to some degree, his populism is going after the white fragility vote. And so I think that's the dynamic.
I agree with that, but yeah.
I think it's true. I think it's absolutely true.
Well, let's get into that for a moment. We'll come back to that.
You know, there's a great book that came out probably a decade ago now called The Whisperers. It's all about life under Stalin and in Russia and how people couldn't speak their minds. And I think a lot of what's going on in the U.S. right now with the rise of Sanders and with the rise of Trump is that people want someone who says out loud what they think. And even though there is so much social media, even though there's so many ways to express yourself, it's almost so many people feel like they can't because they're afraid. I mean, look what goes on at college campuses. I think most of America was amazed to watch what was happening across college campuses over this past year with some of the protests going on, because there's no free speech on campus. There's,
I don't agree with that either. But.
Well, no, but there's, but you can't, you know, you can't just say what you think because you're going to be condemned. You're going to lose your job. I mean, there's so many places in America now where it's where people just feel a little bit afraid, even if they shouldn't. And
that's true.
And I think that's where Sanders and Trump come in and just say these what seem like outrageous things, but they're not really. I think what people they're saying are just things that people think but never have said out loud before. So they're rallying around people who they think are telling the truth.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of I think there's really sort of cogent points being made here in the sense that you've got, you know, basically two angry white guys on both sides of the partisan aisle right now. And so, you know, there is that fear of these really rapid demographic changes that are taking place. And some folks in, you know, particularly in places in the South, the Midwest and the West are really having some issues with accepting that, with or not so much accepting or just being fearful of what that means for the future after being for so long being the majority and now knowing that in 20, 30 years that's not going to be the case anymore. And so there's you know, you've got I think it's there's a little bit of that happening on the left too, but definitely it's happening on the right. And I think the Great Recession has a lot to do with it, with where people now, you know, particularly whites who, you know, may have been, you know, everything seemed to be financially stable. Here comes the Great Recession, which really was a depression. And suddenly they know what it's like to be underserved. They know what it's like to be black or Latino living in a, you know, having your home foreclosed on. And it scares them. And so, you know, enter Bernie Sanders, who basically is on the Democratic side saying, OK, you know, President Obama, like
he's a socialist. He's not a Democrat.
Yeah, step aside. You know, I mean, that's the point with that's the Clint the point Hillary Clinton was trying to make in that PBS debate. Like, you know, trying to make this a litmus test or the election a litmus test about folks' views on President Obama. And so, you know, she basically taking this hit at Sanders, like, okay, you know, you're just basically trying to diminish what President Obama has done and what he's trying to do. And on the right side, I mean, you got Donald Trump, you know, who's basically like, you know, he's representing that piece of the electorate, that segment of the population that's fearful of things that have happened over the Great Recession.
Okay, Lawrence, I'll jump in with a thought. But let me go
and
ahead.
I do think we have to be careful of, you know, false equivalency, which I think is maybe what you're worried about, Mark, that this, you know, are we saying that Trump and Sanders are tapping into the same thing? I don't think they are. But what I do think is that when you had Occupy Wall Street, that was a concern from the left among white youth and disaffected people that Wall Street somehow was taking advantage or really taking away the American dream. And I think it's that notion of white fragility that is expressing itself differently on the right and on the left, but it's still a sense of this dream is not a reality anymore for us. And that is a recognition that I think is spawning the rise of a Donald Trump and the push for a Bernie Sanders, because it's like, can we get our dream back? Now we may raise a question about whether or not that's a distorted dream or a nightmare for other people, but it's still a push for, like, how can we get the American dream that we grew up believing in back?
I think you make a really interesting point. I think that is a part of the dynamic in this race, without a doubt. I mean, I think that. But I think that's right. I think that we are in such a crisis. There may be unemployment may have been driven down under the Obama administration in major ways, and it has. But the economic security of Americans is still very high, no matter who you are.
Many people are not working. I mean, the percentage of people not working is at decades highs.
Yeah, you have to look at participation in the labor
workforce,
force.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think that Hillary's attacks that other night on PBS on Sanders, I took those with a grain of salt. It was kind of politics, raising her stuff. He's not an anti-Obama. He's saying the things like that the healthcare system that we put in there didn't go far enough. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the premiums our little company pays to cover our employees, it didn't go far enough. Mm-hmm. So I think that those things are real. I think that there is a discontent here. And I was saying before you walked in the room, Lawrence, I don't know if I said this in the air or if I said it during the break. I think I said it during the break. But I said that my youngest daughter, who was at UMass Amherst, really interesting. I said, well, who – She said, Dad, who are you voting for? So we talked about that. And I said, well, who are you voting for? She said, I'm voting for Sanders. I said, what about the people in your dorm? And she said, I don't care if they're all in the dorm. Most of the students in the dorm, whether they are white or black or Latino or Asian or Arab American, they're all voting for Sanders. And which was a pretty telling thing in her dorm at Massachusetts. And I think that there's something very – That's why, likening this to 1860, I think we are at a very, very, very explosive moment. I think the whole argument over Obama not being allowed to nominate somebody or being ignored in his nomination to take over Scalia's place, whether they put it off till next term or not, it's all indicative of this crisis America is facing. And I think that's where we are.
Well, socialism is new again. I mean, it's kind of hard to. What's so ironic about this is that it's coming from a 70-year-old man from Vermont talking about these things. So that's what is fascinating to me. But the big question is who's going to vote? Are these young people going to come out and actually vote for Sanders when it counts? So millennials don't vote at the same rate as older people do. So
it's true.
That could be a big.
Yeah, the participation rates for millennials, I mean, they're about 40% for white millennials, 45% for black millennials. And, for seniors, for folks who are 55 plus, it's 70-75%. And on top of that in primaries, I mean, voter turnout in general is just low. I mean, it's on average in a primary, it's 20%. In a primary on either side, whether it's a Democratic or Republican primary. So that's a big question a big question mark for Sanders, whether or not, there's a lot of reliance. And that's why you see Hillary making those types of comments about President Obama, because she knows President Obama plays well, particularly with older black voters who are 45 plus years of age.
Well, I think part of, and I'll just throw this out to you, and then we'll open the phones here in about 10 or 15 minutes we have left, is that I think part of the problem with Hillary Clinton is, and with most of the voters, is her disingenuousness that people feel. I think that when she was questioned on Terry Gross on the NPR, questioned her about her views on gay marriage, and she acted as if she'd always thought the same thing, when clearly she was opposed to gay marriage. It used to be just between a man and a woman, and then she shifted, but won't admit, instead of saying, oh, yes, I've grown from that position, I said that then, but actually everything that's happened in America, I realized that was wrong. This is where I believe. Instead of saying that, she says, oh, no, I've never changed my position. That, to me, is her biggest – that's her Achilles heel.
Well, on top of all the other scandals she's gone through, I mean, the way she handled the whole email scandal is she should have just said, I had my own separate server and it was a mistake, and move on and, admit what was going on in there. And you keep finding more and more emails that could have been classified or were classified, or one saying that you know, she strip it of its classified markings and send it back to me. I mean, there's just so many Benghazi. There's so many different ways. Her, the Clinton Foundation, where people don't trust her on both sides of the aisle. So I think that people are weary.
I want to go back to something I was saying earlier. I was saying that whites 45 and older, well, between 45 and 64 are dying earlier. But the New York Times last month found out that that's actually true also for whites between the ages of 25 and 34. So I do think this sort of anxiety and fragility is amped up in this election, not just in that middle age bracket, but even among younger adults. And I think that's a huge factor that I don't think Hillary Clinton is really tapping into. Maybe she will if she wins and goes to the general election. But I think that's what Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are really honing in on right now.
You know, and it's not even so much that Hillary Clinton is not tapping into it. She just doesn't know how to really articulate it because, you know, she's giving these very very expansive speeches and remarks on the state of the economy and on how she proposes to reverse a lot of these trends, you know, how she wants to reverse the effects of recession, how she wants to put us on a faster path to recovery. You know, she's putting out all these specifics and details, but you know, the state of the electorate right now, they don't want to hear it like that. They don't want to hear it packaged like that.
Well, you know, she's a candidate of triangulation, though, right? She's a candidate that sort of says, "Well, I'm going to see what the polls say." Whereas I think other candidates are saying, "We're going to tap into the sentiment." And we're just going to ride that wave somewhere.
Right. I mean, she's like, I'll go say what I want to Goldman Sachs and let them like what I say, but I'm not going to share that with anyone else. And then I'll go speak to you in the way that you want to be heard, to young people.
But the problem with Hillary Clinton, with the whole Clinton political machine, it's a very transactional political camp or political personality. They're all about transaction politics, which, you know, she's trying to make that sale that, hey, I know, you know, myself and also she's kind of implying and my husband, we know how to cut the deals necessary to kind of get this train moving. Mm-hmm. Folks don't want to hear that. There's a big slice of the electorate right now. They don't want to hear it packaged like they don't like transactional politics anymore because they thought they had this populist politics personified in President Obama. And then, you know, they felt like, well, he was kind of transactional, too, or he came to Washington and he was sort of, you know, he didn't really make the kind of sweeping tsunami-like changes that they thought he would. You know, folks thought he was going to come in there. Because of racism and, you know, and also, you know, folks assuming that, you know, because he's a black man, he's a black president, he was going to come in there like, you know, like Reverend Jesse Jackson or like some, you know, suited up Black Panther and just, you know, and just be able to, and just rail against Congress and just push things through. So, you know, they feel like these guys, Trump and Sanders, they're authentic and they're noisy, they're loud. But, you know, it's like, what happens?
You know, Jesse Jackson, I would put in the same camp as Hillary Clinton. I mean, just old guard. You don't speak for me anymore.
No, absolutely not. I mean, if you look back at those 84, 88 campaigns, I mean, that was the reason why you had so much resistance, particularly within the Democratic rank and file, against the whole notion of a Jesse Jackson presidency. And so now you have even some folks who are looking back on 84, 88, and they're like, man, you know, I wish President Obama was a little bit like Jesse in terms of the ferocity, in terms of ferocity of the art. You know, people are just, they're focused right now on kind of the campaign. But, you know, as with anyone who gets elected to the White House, it's going to be how you govern.
And I think that a couple of things. One, I mean, there's an argument to be made that without Jesse Jackson, there would never have been a Barack Obama. That's a whole other conversation because what he did to open up the Democratic Convention in 88, instead of making a fight, what he did to make to build power inside, one of the reasons that Obama was allowed to be elected. But B, I think that this broad brush we're making, and y'all can disagree with me, but this broad brush we're making about Sanders and Trump as being part of the same continuum, I really don't agree. I mean, at all. I mean, I think there's a huge difference between these two. One is actually putting out substantive ideas, whether you agree with them or not. Mm-hmm. The other is just being bellicose and screaming through the mic. I mean, they're very different characters. They're appealing to a very different political sensibility. I don't see them even close to being the same, other than they both speak on some level to the angst that America is feeling at the moment.
I think there's actually another connection between the two, in spite of what you just said. And that is they're actually very they speak with the muscularity and a masculinity that I think people feel like Barack Obama did not have. I think. Oh yeah, I think because people viewed that he bowed down to the.
So you know, here's an example
earlier.
Of that assessment.
And I agree. I think they feel like when you hear "Make America Great Again," the subtext of that is "Make America masculine and powerful again and muscular again."
I think people are like, you know, I've never heard Trump say make America great again. But look at the PBS debate. Because I remember going back to 2008 when President Obama made that. You know, you're likable enough. Hillary. I mean, people slammed Obama for weeks over that comment. You know, Sanders was really irritable at that debate on PBS the other day. I mean, he was red. He was waving his finger like a kid in the back of the classroom.
And then he made that
really nasty, snarky comment about, well, you're not in the White House yet, which, you know, I mean, I get it. I mean, she's not in the White House yet. Anybody could say it. But it's like there was, you know, it's kind of like he got a pass on that.
Name one candidate who's not made a snarky remark.
Because we're not talking. Here we are. Like, I'm probably the only one who's talking about it.
But I think with Sanders, what you have to pick up on in his masculinity and muscularity is listen to how loudly he speaks. And part of that is because he's Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's what you're
saying. Republic of Brooklyn.
He's not from Plains, Georgia.
His master, Democrat or Republican.
And, you know,
he's
bellicose. I mean, he doesn't shirk and back down and speak humbly. I mean, he speaks like he owns the place.
But the moment,
and I think that's what
both people are. Right. And, yes. And they're we're at a cultural moment when I think that's what people want. They're sick of like following the rules and listening to people because the system is not working for them. The system, Wall Street, is not working for a lot of people, so they're attracted to socialism. I think that it's, you know, Wall Street is basically corporate, you know, crony capitalism, and it's not working because it's not following, you know, real
here's the last point.
Principles.
Here's a real quick last point. Okay, they've done studies on this. They've done research on this where they said, you know, where companies, you know, we know that most Fortune 500 companies, I mean, it's maybe like a handful of black people at best or people of color who are running those companies. And they've done research where they've shown that when these companies get into trouble, when they're like, you know, on teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, you bring, you know, there have been instances, that's the only time where finally you bring in a CEO or a of color or a woman, you know, and during those times to do crisis management. That's when you finally bring in the black CEO. Obama. So in 2008, we brought in the black CEO because we needed crisis management, right? And so now it's like, okay, well, you know, President Black Man, it's all good, you know. You did your job, and we'll take it from here. And that's where I think that's where that argument about, you know, kind of this white fragility or this argument about, I think people want the return of that muscular white male model in the White House.
I think people want America to prosper again. They want jobs. They want, you know, they want
economic
security.
I understand nobody wants to say that, but that's kind of what they want. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I don't think it's this, they want this white vision or this vision of that was early, you know, 19th century, early 20th century America. I think that they just want to feel like there's opportunity for them and for their children going forward. And they're not feeling that right now, whether it's those who are liberal and see socialism as a way out to help with health care or it's those on the right who think that, you know, we want economic opportunity again. There's no entrepreneurs now. There's too many people who are just saddled with student debt to even start to think about starting a business. There's so many things that just can't happen in America right now because of where we're at. And so we're fractured. And I just think that people want to have opportunity again, and they're not getting it.
So I mean, I'll just kind of push a little bit further. I mean, as we're talking about this, I think this is what we're seeing here in this room is where this election is at the moment. And I think there's an intensity about this. And I think the same thing happened in 2008 when President Barack Obama was first elected, which my analysis has always been that a majority of the country, minority of white people, majority of people of color in this country, saw hope in the future embodied in a black man who for them embodied all the oppression this country had and is now going to now be in the White House. I mean, that I think was a big thing, part of the swell that put Barack Obama over. I think that is one of the reasons there was so much pushback on Barack Obama, why this whole century has been about that, from Katrina to Obama to Black Lives Matter. I think that's all part of the same dynamic. And this is why this is this gigantic – that's part of the reason why this is a gigantic rift on where we go. I mean, I think you're seeing inside the black community when you're seeing many younger African-American voters – leaning towards Sanders and some older black American voters leaning towards Clinton.
We're seeing a political tone and tenor. I agree that's very similar to what we saw before the Civil War, in terms of how the parties are you know, the kind of stress that they're under, the kind of duress that they're
serious
under, and
stress.
The kind of decision. Yeah,
right.
I mean that's happening. I think in terms of the economic distress, the economic tone that we're feeling, it's very similar to kind of, you know, Reconstruction, you know, in terms of, you know, after the Civil War, you know, kind of the economic stress that folks were going, not just, you know, blacks or newly freed black slaves, but also whites at the time. And, you know, because there was this, you know, huge kind of this massive reconfiguration that had to take place of the American economy in the wake of the Civil War. So, you know, and I that's where I agree with you, Marta, that there is this, you know, folks are worried. There's a lot of economic insecurity. You know, we've been ignoring, and I haven't personally, but I find it kind of fascinating. I try to listen to those folks, whether I disagree with them or not. But we've been ignoring, once again, that persistent 30% of the electorate that Trump resonates with at our own peril, because those are also the folks who are on a social level. They're also the ones who are now buying guns, or they're the ones who are taking over wildlife refuges. Right. I mean, or even when they take over the Oregon Wildlife Refuge. I mean, did you catch that where the guys who took it over, they were like when after the guy was shot by the police in that shootout, the leader of the ranchers was like, yeah, you know, they shot him like Tamir Rice. I'm like, oh, wow. OK. So, you know, we're starting to, you know, I didn't know how to take that. Speaking of false equivalency, but, you know, but I found that rather, you know, kind of, you know, fascinating that they would actually kind of make that kind of comparison.
Well, we're at this moment. I mean, to go back with to Scalia and just this kind of how pivotal a time we're in is that, I think 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there still was this sort of unified vision of what America should be. And I don't think there is anymore. And that's why we're seeing in our candidates. And there's not a lot of cohesion. And it'll be very fascinating to see who ends up winning, because we could go in very different directions. And
But I do think, you know, this is not the first time we've sort of had this appeal to socialism during the New Deal. Or during the Great Depression, there was an appeal to a socialist-like suite of policies, which were named the New Deal. And you actually find that the rhetoric used to attack public housing, the creation of public housing and the Housing Act of like 39 and some of those subsequent acts, was that public housing was socialist. And it's actually, you can line up the rhetoric of early public housing with the Affordable Care Act very neatly and very seamlessly. Which is also the other irony, which is I don't think socialist is such a bad word in America's public political lexicon anymore.
It's not at all.
In part because Barack Obama took the sting out of it. They called him socialist so much, and the country hasn't fallen apart. Now I think a candidate like Bernie Sanders could come along and people could say, well, that was socialism, and we're still here, and we've gained all these jobs, and we've come out of the recession. Maybe we need a little more of it.
That's interesting. You don't find a double standard in that, though.
No, I actually think that
you see what I'm saying?
Bernie Sanders should give Barack Obama credit for taking the sting,
which he's not,
out of the label,
which he's not, which Bernie Sanders is not.
Right.
That's
why I say. I mean,
it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like it's kind of like, you know, Bernie Sanders inherit like the Wall Street speculation tax. I mean, that's not Bernie Sanders' idea. That's Chaka Fatah's idea.
He didn't say it was his idea. Chaka Fatah was the one who'd been around for years.
I mean, where was Bernie Sanders since like 2004 for the transaction tax, the 1% transaction tax?
No, man. As congressman senator, he's always been for the transaction tax. It's not something he just made out of whole cloth. And that idea of transaction tax has been around for a long time. People have been debating that. They've just been ignored because it was Chaka raised it and people on the left raised it.
Fatah had actually introduced a bill that everybody roundly criticized and ridiculed. I mean, this has been going on since 2004. He's been trying to get it passed like every year. Nobody's taking the mantle up on it. So suddenly we have an election.
But what I'm saying is Sanders supported that in Congress, and he's not making up that he supported it.
But see, I think that's you know, okay. The reason why I raise
and
that,
whether you
I think
like Sanders or not, I mean,
the reason
there's a lot of things to dislike about him,
right?
But not what he actually.
Well, the reason why I raise that is because I think that's a big part of the problem. Why you're having, you know, one, you are having this generational split within the black political community over Sanders and Clinton. But also, I think that's the problem as far as Sanders' relationship with the black political community. That's what you hear. You know, they're like, well, where was this guy? You know, they're like, you know, it's like, we've been working on, you know, pieces of legislation, bills like the transaction tax.
Well, where
were
the Clintons? Cutting welfare, putting people in jail.
You know, well, no, but black elected officials. And, you know,
the counter on that
was black elected officials on the state, local, and federal level were also, they wanted the crime bill just as much as Bill Clinton wanted.
Some of them did. But we have final, really quick, 30-second thoughts. We have to go to our next segment. People are waiting to hold on.
Make America great again means make America muscular and masculine again.
No, I think you're so right, Charles, about socialism, though. I don't think it's a dirty word anymore. And it's, and, you know, Republicans think that by saying that, it's going to scare people, and it just doesn't for the younger generation.
Well, I want to thank the three. This has been great. This is a really great, good, lively discussion. A lot of content, a lot of life. Thank you all so much. Josh Ellison, political strategist of the Ellison Report, here on WEA every Sunday night at 9. And Marta Mossberg, visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute. Good to have her back in the studio. Dr. Lawrence Brown, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health at the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University, and one of our leading activists in this community. Good to have the three of you here. Thank you so
much. Always
a
pleasure. Hey, thanks, man.
We're going to take a short break and come back. Stanley Nelson is with us. The Panthers are out on PBS tonight. We're going to talk about his film, Taking the Country by Storm, where it's going next. Don't go away.